Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
IVF, surrogacy, donor sperm, intercountry adoption. They're just some of the options available to infertile couples wanting to create a family. What are some of the ethical issues around those options, though? What are the kind of questions that a couple should be asking before they walk down one of those pathways? Well, Dr. Tom Frame is director of the St. Mark's National Theological Center, and he's written a book called Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. And he joins us now. It's good to talk to you on the show again, Tom.
It's good to be with you again.
We need to set the context, really, this rising infertility in the Western world. What can we place that down to?
Well, a number of things. I mean, there seems to be some medical causes. Some are known, some are not. But certainly it's the case that many people are living lives that lead them to make decisions about marriage and having children later on. Now, we know that women, when they get to 35, their fertility is halved and it's almost non-existent when they're 41, 42. So some of the infertility that we're seeing in the Western world is simply that which is a product of social choices that people have made.
And that leads us then to look at this very issue of then, as you put it, the ethics of defying nature, trying to actually overcome what then turns out to be the barriers. Our whole attitude to having children has changed over the years, hasn't it?
Oh, it has. It has. I mean, it was previously the case that nature dictated, so people understood it, certain things. What would happen is that people would, in most instances, find a partner, they would then marry, they would then have children. For those who are unable to have children for whatever reason, they would seek to adopt a child. Now, I was born in 1962. Adoption was very, very common in that particular year. And most people who faced infertility, who were married in stable relationships, were able within 2 to 3 years to be given a child, and they would raise that child as their own, and therefore in one sense infertility was overcome.
Now, you actually touched there on your own year of birth. You've got a professional interest in this as an ethicist and a theologian, but also a personal interest because you personally were adopted, weren't you?
That's right. Yes, I was the mistake, if it can be called that, of a 16-year-old girl. She fell pregnant. My actual birth mother had been abandoned by her mother before she was two, so she has no memory of her own birth mother. She was raised by a grandmother. So she had me just after she turned 17. She was unable to care for me, and so I was offered for adoption. And the Frames, my original name was Ronald Parker, the Frames came along at the end of 1962 when I was about 5 weeks old. They'd made application in the early part of 1961, so it was less than 2 years, and they were offered me. I was then bundled up from the hospital where I was born in Sydney, in Stanmore, and taken to Wollongong where I was raised. And for me, being adopted is something that I've gone through life reflecting on from different times with different interests, because when I was younger, I was always wanting to see people about the age I thought my parents would be and wondering, well, if this person looks like me, perhaps that's my mother or my father. Mm. And then when I then became a parent, it was only after I became a parent, I began to think, well, I'm not actually sure genetically what I may be passing on to my own children. Maybe I should begin to look, because that information will be crucial to my children. And now I'm actually a grandfather. What I'm finding is that how I understand myself as a person and how I see people developing in the world is quite complicated. And we're, in many ways, a mosaic. There's lots of things that make up the picture that we are. And certainly I continue to think that biological parents are central pieces in that mosaic.
Mm. You actually tracked down your birth mother in the end, didn't you?
I did. It took some time, and it was a real fluke, the means by which I found her. But I did find her in 1994. We had a number of short meetings. I found them very, very difficult. I mean, many of the listeners might think that it's a fairy tale come true. But what you do find is someone who very often is not what you expect, mm. that lives have gone in different directions, particularly if there's no obvious physical likeness, and if there isn't either an emotional or an intellectual one, you can stand or sit across a table from someone, like I did with my mother, and we both tried to guess the ways in which we were similar, and at the end of a couple of hours after our first meeting, we just thought we were totally different, and there actually wasn't a great deal to discuss.
Right, wow. That raises the very issue of identity, which is a very common thread to a lot of the discussion we're going to have, I think, from this point on. Because a person who's adopted, you yourself actually mentioned that you were born Ronald Parker. you grew up as Tom Frame. Your very name was changed. That's an identity issue. Children conceived through, technologically assisted means, the whole question of identity is very big.
Oh, sure, and that's absolutely right. And you draw attention properly to it, because my concern is about the way in which people construct identity. Now, part of it, identity, comes from the biological composition that we, in part, were given by our parents. Now, we also know that we are formed, that we are shaped, we are influenced by the environments in which we live. I, as a Christian person, believe also that God has a particular hand in shaping the people that we are. Mm. And if it is true that we all bear the divine image, then there's something about God that's evident, present, and reflected in me that is not to be seen in anyone else, because I'm unique, and I know that because I look at my hand and see fingerprints that no one else on earth has. Mm. So coming to a sense of who we are, why we're on this earth, and what we might make of our lives is a complex undertaking. It changes as we get older. It changes as we have different experiences. But it is important to know, I think, at one level, biologically, what have we received from another? In what ways are we like those who have come before us? In what ways are we dissimilar to those that have come before us? And in a world in which people find it very, very difficult to work out who they are, that information is crucial, I believe.
Okay, this is Open House, and we're talking to Dr. Tom Frame. He's written this book called Children on Demand. We're talking about the ethics of, those, you could say, new forms, because they haven't come up in the last two or three decades, of creating a family, particularly for infertile couples. Okay, Tom, with those things in mind, with what you've just mentioned there about identity in mind, let's explore some of those forms of creating a family when the natural option just isn't available for some means. Now, we started talking about your experience of adoption. Local adoption happening with families within Australia, has actually decreased quite dramatically over the last couple of decades. Give us the background behind what's going on there.
Yes, I even think saying it's decreased dramatically is probably understating. It's absolutely collapsed. I mean, the year that I was born, 1962, there were nearly 3,000 babies in New South Wales alone.
Boy.
The figure in 1972 was pushing up on 10,000 babies were available for adoption. Everyone thought it would surpass 10,000. It didn't quite get there. But in the space of just on 30 years, we've gone from 10,000 babies or thereabouts to less than 100. Now, that is an utter collapse in this particular means of dealing with infertility and childlessness. I suspect in Australia this year, the number of local adoptions may be something in the order of about 50 to 60. Now, the big change, of course, was when the Whitlam government in 1973 decided it would have a supporting parents benefit to help women retain and care for the children that they previously might have relinquished. So we're seeing a huge drop away in the numbers. And for most people, I would have to say, local adoption, if they are successful, will be a great blessing to them, because many, many people are trying. Unfortunately, fewer people are able to have their need for children met in that way. When it comes to overseas adoptions, many people are choosing that particular route for a number of reasons. One of them is that in some countries there are a lot of abandoned children, and this is a way of caring for a child that otherwise probably would grow up in an institution. I myself don't have a problem with inter-country adoption on a number of fronts. I mean, I'm concerned that a child is Chinese, may be taken out of China, but I've met many, many parents who've had intra-country adoptions, and they've been willing to take their children back to China, back to the province, and even maybe the city or the town from which the child was originally adopted. Mm. So there's some scope there for adoption. Now, the problem is, of course, that Australia previously had the view that when you're adopted, it was a life sentence. You weren't able to find information about those who were your relinquishing parents. But we no longer have that view. And in many ways, what we are saying is we are separating children from their parents by 18 years or a little bit more, and that those children then, if they want, in most cases, are able to get identifying information and perhaps pick up some of the threads, get to know someone to whom they have a biological relationship. And many adoptees say that's very important, as indeed I believed it was important in my own life.
Mm. That's a key issue, isn't it? Is that if you are a couple who are looking to adopt either locally or particularly internationally, you really need to be thinking about the best interests of the child later on down the track, and how, I guess there might be, particularly for Christians, maybe even a sense of, oh, we're going to rescue this child. And yet you've got to work out ways in which that child can find out their own history, their own heritage, their own identity, what they're connected to.
Yes, and look, I think the willingness to do that is important at the same time as people recognise that, say, in the case of China or maybe in some African countries, that simply isn't possible because the poor child has quite literally been abandoned, that people have placed the child and run away for whatever reason. And it may be that the child will never know any information other than it came from this country or this region or something like that. But a willingness at least to let the child maybe experience that place may be significant to that child of kind of connecting. Now, there are people here who look like me, and one of the things I suppose was easier for me because I'm you know blonde hair, blue eyes, and look like everybody else or most other people in Australia at the time I was born. It wasn't obvious to anybody that I was adopted. Whereas in a family where plainly they're two Europeans, when they have a Chinese child or an Asiatic-looking child, then that child's going to have to go through life people saying, "How come you look like that when your parents look like this?" And the child will obviously say, "Well, I'm adopted," and I do think though, if the parents are willing to let it connect with that place from which it came, that's a good thing. But even I think Sheridan, even say we want to rescue children, I perhaps wouldn't use that word.
Exactly.
But if people are wanting a child, and there's an altruistic element, which is that they're prepared to take a stranger and make a stranger a loved one, to bring them into the middle of the home and to love the child, then I think that's no bad thing. I mean, one of the most motifs that we have in the Christian story is that God adopts us. That's what Paul talks about. You know, we are adopted into the family of God. So I think people who are willing to do that, not to be white knights, but, we want to have children, we want to care for children. And overseas, there are children who are, if we don't welcome them into our society, will be institutionalised. And I don't think anybody wants that.
Mm. Okay, so the story starts to get a little bit more complex than when we move for adoption, where there already has been a life created who needs, a family to be a part of, to then say artificial conception and the various forms that start to happen as a result of that, where you're actually starting to create new life. So there's donor gametes and donor sperm and things like that. Now, walk us through some of the ethical considerations we should be thinking about if we want to go down this path.
Well, I suppose the first and the obvious one is will the identity of the person who is the donor, either the sperm or the egg, will they be known? What information has been recorded about them? What kind of medical conditions might they have? Will it be important later on in the child, perhaps, if it does need donated material, say for transplants or whatever, to actually have contact with that person if they find that there's a very, very small pool of people who can assist them if they need a bone marrow or rare blood types and things like that? What kinds of people also will donate sperm and eggs? Are they particular kinds of people? Or, to turn it around the other way, what happens if a parent wants a particular kind of donor? Will we find all sorts of strange choices being exercised by people who say, "I don't want a Chinese child," or "I don't want a black child," or "I want a child that's got blonde hair"? So there's always the fear of this design of babies. We don't have what, if you like, nature serves us up. We begin to play around with what we know of technology and people's readiness to donate. I'd like a child that looked like this actor or this actress. And so we, I think, would be a little bit nervous because it's starting to say things that human beings are not all equal. Some, it seems, are more equal than others. And a sense that could be saying things in our society that we don't want said about some groups of people.
The very issue of donor sperm does raise a lot of questions, doesn't it? Because then you've got a husband and a wife, they can't conceive, then they kind of, say, bring in a donor egg or donor sperm from a man, if that's the case.
You well, for do some then... people, Sheridan, I mean, some people, they would say that is adultery, that is introducing genetic material from someone else, not in the marriage bond. Now, I don't actually take that view. I'm concerned about donor sperm for lots of reasons, but there will be some listeners, I think, who will say, "Well, hang on, we're actually concerned about having this third person interfere in this couple's relationship." Now, they may welcome it, and the other person may have an anonymous role. But what it means is that you have a child, say if it's donor sperm, the child is biologically related to its mother, not to its father. And there have been situations we know where children in these circumstances have said to mum, "I'll listen to you, but not to dad, because he's not really my dad." They have an unequal kind of relationship, or at least some children can play it in that way. Well, my father's out there somewhere and he'd understand, but you don't.
Yes.
Now, children can play those kind of games. I mean, adults can play them as well. But you do have an unequal kind of relationship. you also then have the possibility that later on in life, what happens if the child is wanting to go search for the donor, and the donor then wants to play some role in the child's life. That's going to be difficult for the social father, if we can call that man that, to come to terms with having to share their child with another man.
This is Open House. We'll podcast this via the openhouse.net.au. Dr. Tom Frame is with us. We're talking about some of the ethical quandaries of reproductive technologies. Okay, well, a step on from that is surrogacy, where maybe the husband and the wife can't simply conceive for other reasons, but the sperm's okay, her eggs are okay, and then a woman comes into the situation and actually carries the child. Walk us through some of the ethical considerations to think about there.
Well, I mean, one of them is that in the United States, where many things happen that can't happen in Australia, I mean, there's reproductive tourism, people going to the United States because locally they can't find someone willing to be a surrogate, but in the United States, someone's willing to be paid to be one. And it's not contrary to American law for a woman to offer her womb to be a commercial surrogate. And there are all sorts of problems, Sheridan, that develop in this particular sense, in that, you know, what happens if the surrogate smokes or lives a particular lifestyle that may create problems for the child in utero, which those of the commissioning couple will have to live with later in life. That's been a real issue. We've had disabled children born, and the commissioning couple have said, well, hang on, this is not what we paid for. And then the surrogate says, but it's not my child. And you've had crazy situations where children have been 2 and 3 years old in foster care and wards of the state because no one actually wants the poor little things. The other thing that's concerned about surrogacy, and we know this from the Australian experience, is that women are damaged by surrogacy. Now, they may say before being a surrogate, I think I'll be okay, or I'm doing it for my sister, or I'm doing it for my friend, and I'm happy to do it. But women, all women who have been surrogates, have reported feelings of great anxiety, of pain, some even of having a crisis in life. They were that child's mother for 9 months. Their body and everything about their being got them ready to be a mother. When they give birth, they then give the child away. And many, many women have said, this is so painful, I would never do it again. And in fact, I'm not aware of any case where a woman has been a surrogate in Australia twice. There may have been, I'm not aware of those cases, but most women have said, look, once was enough, I just couldn't do it again. And when they see that child, if it's family or friend, and it usually is an altruistic surrogacy, they see that child grow up. There's a bit of them that continues to want to embrace the child as a mother would embrace its child, but it can't do that because biologically it's not the mother if it didn't provide the egg, and certainly that's going to be disruptive to that family. So surrogacy, on the one hand, looks straightforward, but in practice is a little more complicated.
Let's move on to IVF. That's become probably one of the most popular forms of helping infertile couples actually start to create a family. In fact, isn't this the 30th anniversary of IVF's creation? I think Louise Brown, she might have been celebrating her 30th birthday this year, isn't that right?
In fact, next month.
Next month?
In July. Yeah. In July, Louise is 30, and I'm sure that she's thinking, I hope everybody leaves me alone, but they won't, because these kind of, you know, round-year anniversaries are always pretty popular. So, you know, she's 30 next month.
Yes. Now, the issue with very popular technologies is we start to not think too much about them ethically. What are some of the questions we should be asking about IVF?
Well, I suppose the first one is that who will provide the material? Now, the reproductive material, we touch on that a little bit, but the question, I suppose, that's become very controversial is, will we require those who have access to IVF technology to be in stable, committed relationships, preferably bordered by marriage? Now, that is, I think, arising from the conviction of our society that children are best raised in relationships where they will enjoy the complementary care of a man and a woman who are their father and their mother. Now, we've had a lot of agitation in the community about having single people have access to IVF and also those in same-sex couples. Mm. Now, these are very, very controversial issues. I tried to deal with them in the book in such a way as to continue to draw attention to what is in the best interests of children. And my argument is, first of all, that two parents are better than one. And anyone who's had to, I don't remember when our children were small and my wife went off in an army camp, she was in the army reserve, and it was just me trying to deal with two little toddlers for 2 weeks. By the end of it, I just couldn't wait for her to get back. So I do think that two parents are better than one. Now, the question of same-sex couples, my view is that humanity consists of men and women, male and female-ness, and therefore children need, for them to grow up as complete beings, they need the complementary care of a man and a woman. Now, that's what nature presently requires, and I think there's a certain abiding logic in that. We learn different things from men and from women, and that's true for children. Mm-hmm. Therefore, what I would want is for those who have access to IVF to be in stable, opposite-sexed relationships, because that's what's best for children.
Yes. There's also a question raised with the amount of eggs that are fertilised in the first place with IVF, and then what happens to surplus embryos before they're actually implanted back into the mother. You can have couples who, in the end, are actually successful in, through the IVF procedure, actually having a number of embryos created, maybe 8, maybe 9, maybe 12, and yet maybe they're successful with the first embryo being implanted back in the woman, and there's a question mark with what do we do with those embryos that are left over?
Yes, that's right. Now, some people have no problems at all. They just say, well, look, you know, they're excess to requirement, and therefore we'll allow them to succumb. We'll just let them thaw and we'll discard them. But I simply can't do that. I think there's more to what we have done than just simply created some cells. I suppose it's the question that would touch on a range of issues, from abortion to the issue that we're touching on now. But certainly we know in Australia at the present time there are quite literally thousands of embryos that will never be implanted, and that decisions will have to be made about their destruction. Now, for some people, they say that's not a big issue. For others, it is. Certainly, it does seem to be the case. As technology has improved, we require less embryos to be made, but there will, generally speaking, be some left over, and it's an issue we need to confront, and we haven't yet confronted it as well as we ought.
And then, while we're talking on this particular topic, there's the whole issue of posthumous parenthood, where perhaps some sperm from a male who has now deceased is actually frozen and then used later by a woman to try and conceive. What are your ethical considerations on that one?
Well, I mean, the first one would be that I don't think that it's right to bring a child into being who will never know its father. Now, some children are brought into being who will not know their father because their father may have died after their mother conceived, but we don't do that deliberately. We don't knowingly bring children, I'm saying we ought not to knowingly bring children into the world who will never know their father. It's one thing to know their name, it's another thing to have an experience of them. And there's also questions about property. I mean, if we do have sperm stored for 100 years, you know, it's quite possible that some of the world's worst dictators, you might get rid of them in one generation, but find they bob up, you know, 50, 60 years later, because essentially their children are brought into being by, you know, by all sorts of processes. I think Victoria, the state of Victoria, is right in that its legislation requires that when a person dies, all of their reproductive material goes with them, and therefore they don't, if you like, outlive their bodies. And I think there's much to be said for that. I am very concerned about the notion of you know, bringing children into being because, for instance, they remind someone of the partner that they lost. That isn't a reason for bringing children into the world, in my view.
We're talking with Dr. Tom Frame on Open House tonight. Theopenhouse.net.au has the podcast. He's the author of many books, and this latest one is called Children on Demand. We're talking about the ethics of various reproductive technologies. You know, it's so easy for us to sit here and talk about the ethical aspects of creating a family. But for a couple who really can't have children, it is a very heartbreaking thing. And yet, particularly, say, for the Christians that are amongst us, that we're talking to, we're listening to, we're hearing from, there is a desire to do the right thing. If you were to bring it down to a handful of, I guess, guidelines when it comes to creating a family when you are an infertile couple, could you bring those down to a few guidelines, a few rules, a few questions that we could ask ourselves?
Well, I think the first one is to say that the relationship that men and women are called into by God is a sacred and a holy one, and that is really important, and that the love they have for each other, if they're willing to expand it to include others, principally children, then that is a good thing. If it so happens that they can't have children, I don't think anyone should believe that it's a curse from God. I think in ancient societies that was the view. We now know, for all sorts of genetic reasons and biological reasons, that people have difficulty conceiving, and that this is kind of what happens in a world such as ours, and I don't think necessarily there's any divine condemnation involved in that. I mean, lives can be enjoyable, profitable, and ones that give glory to God without people necessarily bringing children into the world. Certainly it's the case that in the Christian tradition, those who have been single have also been much blessed and been a blessing because they've been single. Certainly I would say to people that if you decide to pursue by whatever means possible a desire to have children, you may actually create a number of ethical dilemmas that you hadn't considered, and that you might find yourself in situations where you have to choose the lesser of two evils. And that's what you should always want to avoid. In other words, it doesn't matter what you do, it's not a good choice. Or you've actually brought about a situation where there's been more harm than help in whatever place you were trying to act. So I think we need to stand back from these technologies particularly and say, well, if we do that, this situation arises, what is our response to that? The other thing I suppose that I'd say, Sheridan, is that there are children in the community, perhaps those of siblings or other people, and we can be not parents to them, but we can care for them in different sorts of ways. The idea of a child solely being cared for by its mother and father is a relatively new one. In many societies and in most periods of human history, children were brought up within communities. And all of us, I think, have influence on children, be they children of our friends, those we might meet at church, if we're teachers. Lots of people are contributing to what children become, and therefore simply to have your own, to be proprietorial about it, that's just, I think, overlooking many, many of the options, and I think some biblical principles about the right attitude to have towards children.
Mm. Well, Tom, fascinating to talk to you. Really appreciate your time at Open House tonight. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, as always.
Yeah, that's Dr. Tom Frame. He's the director of the St. Mark's National Theological Centre in Canberra. And he's the author of this book, Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. It's published through University of New South Wales Press.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.